Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak to Richard Friedman about Trump's mental health and fitness for office, or lack thereof. Richard is a professor of psychiatry at the Cornell Weill School of Medicine in New York. Then we'll be joined by Mark Gotze. Mark is a former prosecutor who went on to found the Ohio Innocence Project. He has a new book out, Blind Injustice, about how cognitive biases and various political incentives can lead police and prosecutors and judges to not only make mistakes that cost innocent people their freedom, but then also to fight like hell to keep them behind bars, even when definitive evidence of their innocence emerges. It's very different than the kind of romanticized vision that we have from Hollywood movies, right? Where the plucky detective or the overmatched defense attorney or intrepid political reporter, investigative reporter, finds the key piece of evidence that absolves somebody. And then the next scene, you see that person is on the courthouse steps being greeted by loved ones. It doesn't work that way in the real world. People spend years on end in prison, even when it's clear and can be proven that they're innocent. But first, by the time you hear this, the government may have shut down. I'm recording on Friday afternoon, and last-minute negotiations are underway to avert a shutdown even as I speak. Maybe they'll come to fruition. Maybe there won't be a shutdown, but it's not looking good at the moment. Depending on what poll you read, around 50%+ of the population would blame Republicans for the shutdown, versus around 30% who would lay the responsibility with the Dems. This is a testament to the conservative media, I guess, because you have to be extraordinarily cynical to even try to spin this as the fault of Democrats. And just, you know, keep in mind that Trump unilaterally decided to end DACA, the Obama-era policy that spared children brought into the country illegally from deportation. That was an executive action, and he can undo that with a stroke of a pen at any time. CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, enjoyed broad bipartisan support for years. The Republicans controlled both chambers of Congress and the White House. They allowed funding for CHIP to expire 112 days ago. So now they're holding these millions of poor, sick kids hostage by offering Dems a six-year extension of the health insurance program. They're holding the DACA recipients hostage by offering Dems a six-year extension of the health insurance program if they'll kick the so-called dreamers under the bus and pass a bill to keep the government open. But Dems have no reason to believe that anything will move for the dreamers if they give up the little bit of leverage that they have with the spending bill. And that's really what it comes down to. 120 dreamers are losing their protected status every day, and they're subject to deportation. There is overwhelming popular sentiment against deporting them. A poll found that 87% of Americans are against deporting the dreamers. And so they're saying, you know, pass this bill or we will ruin these kids' lives, basically. So this is a crisis, so-called crisis, entirely fabricated by Republicans. They're playing the same game that they did under Obama. They're refusing to support even, you know, the most basic legislation that keeps the lights on unless they get some of the items on their toxic wish list. But the difference is that they control all three branches of government. It's all on them. And it's on House Republicans specifically and Donald Trump for refusing to accept the very conservative compromise that a bunch of senators worked out, a bipartisan compromise. They basically sent a bill to the Senate that won't get 50 Republican votes. And let me repeat that. Never mind talk of 60 votes or the filibuster. The bill doesn't have 50 Republican votes to pass the Senate with Mike Pence as a tiebreaker. So they are negotiating with themselves and unable to bring those negotiations to fruition. And these people then have the nerve to call it the Schumer shutdown and blame Dems. If they haven't worked out a deal by the time you hear this, then just keep in mind that this shutdown is entirely unprecedented. There has never been such a thing when one party controls the entire government. It's not normal for lawmakers to take hostages when they're in charge. Now, again, there was a bipartisan compromise to help the Dreamers in the works. I thought it was a very bad compromise. It gave a couple billion dollars for Trump's wall boondoggle. It would have done away with family-based visas, for example, and increased visas for so-called underrepresented countries like Norway, I guess. And Trump put the kibosh on that deal. There was a report in Axios this week that he did so because he saw something on Fox and Friends about the emerging bipartisan deal that enraged him. So this is the president of the United States making policy decisions based on what the very dumbest people on cable TV have to say. I mean, it's a ridiculous, ridiculous way to govern. And all of this is because Donald Trump couldn't get Mexico to pay for the wall. By the way, he keeps saying that he, in fact, will get Mexico to pay for the wall, directly or indirectly. So he says he's going to renegotiate NAFTA and somehow force the Mexicans to pay for his stupid wall. The other news this week that I think was one of the less pleasant shiny objects to distract us was the fact that Trump paid $130,000 in hush money through shell companies and false names or whatever through his lawyer, his consigliere slash lawyer, Michael Cohen, to Stormy Daniels, a porn star. I think that the news that he is awful in bed has to be among the least surprising news in the history of unsurprising news. But the thing that you know about this story is that it's all baked into the cake, right? I mean, Trump supporters, they knew what they were getting. They knew that he was a pussy grabber in chief. It is unlikely that this story of sleeping with a porn star while his third wife was pregnant with their child is going to affect his support among evangelicals, white evangelicals. The same people, by the way, who thought that Barack Obama, many of whom thought that Barack Obama, a good God-fearing, church-going family man, was the Antichrist, right? Because he's black. The New York Times ran an entire editorial page this week, just letters from Trump voters. This is their obsession with telling us, giving us supposedly this kind of anthropological study of the types of people who supported Trump. The thing about these endless features about Trump supporters in Trump country still supporting Trump, still supporting Trump and Trump country, is that they're totally uninformative. They don't reveal anything that we didn't know. Partisanship is a really powerful drug. We live in a time when we're increasingly siloed in our media consumption. We tend to gravitate towards news outlets that confirm our previously held positions. And they've just decided that he's a good Christian man, and they're gonna stick by him through thick and thin. Partisanship is a hell of a drug, and yeah, that's where we are. Stormy Daniels not gonna have a big impact. As a matter of fact, his approval ratings have been trending upwards ever so slightly this week. Anyway, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Richard Friedman. Back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. Donald Trump said last week that he was a very stable genius, not just a genius, not an ordinary genius, but a very stable one, which is, of course, what all extremely stable geniuses say. That set off yet another round of questions about the president of the Electoral College's mental fitness for the office. Is the guy with his finger on the giant but non-existent nuclear button all there? My next guest knows a thing or two about mental illness. Richard Friedman is a professor of clinical psychiatry and the director of psychopharmacology clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. And he wrote an op-ed last week for the Washington Post titled, "No, Trump Doesn't Need a Mental Fitness Evaluation." You can check it out at washingtonpost.com, all one word. Richard, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Pleasure to be here, Josh.
Thank you so much for taking the time. So intuitively, one would think that the possibility, the mere possibility that a guy with the power to destroy the entire planet is suffering from mental illness would be a pressing question of public concern. But you say it's not the right question. Why not?
Right. Well, I would ask the question slightly differently. The issue about Trump's mental state and his stability and, say, suitability to actually be the president is something that non-experts can see for themselves every single day. I mean, because what Americans see when they watch the president or listen to the president is someone who is dishonest, impulsive, ignorant, staggeringly ignorant about any issue related to even the most basic functions of his job, irascible, thin-skinned. In other words, all the kinds of characteristics that should scare the average citizen when they see this is the person with the most awesome power on earth. Now, those things are visible to the naked eye. Now, you're speaking to a psychiatrist, but those are the sorts of things that any American can see, and you don't need an expert to tell you this.
Right. So, I mean, what you're basically saying is that there is, you don't need the professional judgment of a psychiatrist or a psychologist to just see that this is a president who suffers from these kind of classical narcissistic traits, as you say, thin-skinned. He can't handle criticism of any kind without lashing out. He's constantly self-congratulatory. He surrounds himself with psychophants, etc., etc.
Right.
It's right there for all of us to see. Now, here's the counterpoint. This is by Bandy Lee and Norm Eisen. Lee is a psychiatrist. Eisen's a transparency advocate. And they wrote in the USA Today, and I quote, "Not to frame and discuss these questions leaves public officials, the press, and the people, the president's ultimate employers, to fend for themselves without the benefit of the special expertise of psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health professionals. That can only raise anxiety levels. Nothing is more disconcerting than being left in the dark." So are you leaving us lay people to fend for ourselves?
Hardly. I mean, that statement itself to me is misguided, because at its root, the assumption is you need us experts to help you understand a phenomenon that anyone with an average ability to understand things should be able to see. They're privileging their importance in a way which is, to my view, you know, misguided. You know, if it turned out, let's say, just hypothetically, let's argue that he had a mental illness, whatever it is, depression, anxiety, that in and of itself would say nothing about his fitness for office, obviously. Lots of people with mental illness function at very high levels, and we've had lots of presidents who've had psychiatric illness. I mean, to name a few, Abraham Lincoln, one of the greatest, severely depressed. You know, and Johnson and Grant, and, you know, there have been a number of presidents well documented by historical records who had, you know, various, you know, mental problems while they were in office. And they functioned. So that by itself is not sufficient. And the converse is also true. You know, if it turns out that Trump were examined by a psychiatrist and he revealed everything inside his mind and no one could come to a diagnosis whatsoever, he'd still be incompetent, unfit for office. So to my view, having a psychiatric illness is neither necessary nor sufficient to determine fitness for office. It should be simply function, day-to-day function. You don't need a fancy label. In fact, it takes away a fundamental, to me, a fundamental democratic process, which is, you know, Americans have the ability to evaluate this guy on the campaign trail, watch his behavior, look what he's like during the debates. They all knew it. They all saw it. All his behavior was visible. People got a good sampling of what Trump was like all along, and they elected him. Now, I mean, yes, he lost the popular vote, but he won in the Electoral College. So you could say, you know, the Americans exercised due diligence of a sort, and they chose him anyway.
I think it's really important to stress this point. For you, it's obvious as a mental health professional that mental illness alone isn't disqualifying, but I don't think that that is something that is widely perceived among the public. And I really think that it's something that we need to emphasize, that, you know, we live in a society that stigmatizes mental illness.
Right.
Just the fact that the president suffers from a mental illness is not unto itself inherently disqualifying. And in your piece, you cited a study by two researchers at Duke University that suggests, as you mentioned, that mental illness, that 18 of our first 37 presidents met criteria for some sort of clinical psychiatric disorder.
Right.
So I think that we really need to stress this point. It's important to understand, just because we do stigmatize the mentally ill, and it does not help anything. Now, in the piece, you also talk about the limits of psychological and indeed physiological testing, the limits of what they could tell us. What could a mental health evaluation actually reveal, and what might it not reveal?
Well, I mean, a mental health evaluation, which is conducted by interview, obviously, because you have to talk to a human being and ask them, you know, what their feelings and what their thoughts are like, depends on their honesty and their openness, which, as you know, with Trump is highly questionable. In fact, we already know the answer. He is an inveterate liar. And so it's highly unlikely that he would submit to an interview. And if he did, you know, it would be uninformative simply because he's not likely to tell you what he really thinks and what he feels. The best way to determine that is just simply to observe his behavior and make an inference. So, I mean, that's not a particularly useful thing. The interview, which is the instrument of a psychiatric evaluation, wouldn't be all that helpful. What's more helpful in President Trump's case is just to observe his behavior and make a reasonable guess about what lies behind it. And in terms of some of the more, you know, sort of technological or biological means of evaluating mental function, you know, yes, there are things that we can do when we suspect that somebody might have a biological process or a medical illness that is contributing to the mental problem. For example, let's say somebody has a cognitive problem and has trouble with memory or focus or concentration, and you suspect that they may be in the early stages of a dementia. You know, you might do a brain imaging study, like an fMRI. But even that is really not sufficient. It's not diagnostic, because you could easily have an MRI which shows all kinds of you know, artifact and abnormality that's of no clinical significance. And the converse is true. You can have somebody who's profoundly disturbed, maybe someone who's delirious, whose, you know, ability to pay attention, to be oriented, is really completely disturbed, and they would have a normal MRI. So it isn't going to help you one way or the other.
Now, what do you think of the ethical standard? It's commonly referred to as the Goldwater Rule, which says that professionals should avoid diagnosing public figures. In the piece, you focus on some of the practical limitations to these kinds of tests.
Right.
Do you think those who disagree with you and do offer a diagnosis from afar are violating a valid ethical constraint, or is the imperative to keep a check on the executive branch such a vital interest that it overrides that, just from an ethical standpoint alone?
Right. So, I mean, the Goldwater Rule, which came in the wake of, you know, the Barry Goldwater and the 64 election, came because, you know, American psychiatrists were polled at the time for their opinion about Goldwater, and they savaged him. I mean, they called him schizophrenic and psychotic, and I made all kinds of psychological interpretations of someone they'd never met, never interviewed, and someone obviously who would never have consented to any of that. And, you know, he sued them. He went to the Supreme Court, and they lost, and he won, I think, $1 symbolically in damages. And out of it came the Goldwater Rule, which basically said, you know, mental health professionals should not make a diagnosis of a public official, somebody who they have not personally examined. Why? Because, I mean, for a couple of reasons. One, it's not ethical. You know, the person has not consented. Two, in order to do it, I mean, it's intellectually dishonest because, you know, in order to make a diagnosis, you need to collect a lot of information, which you're not going to be able to get unless you personally examine someone and you interview them and you collect whatever lab data is necessary. And then putting all that together, you make a diagnosis. But that said, what a lot of people don't understand about Goldwater is the Goldwater Rule specifically encourages mental health professionals to educate the public. And there are plenty of things that I or any other mental health professional can say about Trump that would help the public understand his behavior, short of giving a diagnosis and tell them everything they need to know. So, for example, I could say within the stricture of the Goldwater Rule that, you know, if you see the behavior of Trump and the average person, that is his grandiosity, his thin skins, you know, his irritability, et cetera, that's typical of narcissistic psychology. And or you could say something like, you know, for a president who seems to have such an impoverished vocabulary, who repeats simple phrases over and over again, if you saw that in the average person, it would raise a question about cognitive function, and it would be reasonable to have them evaluated for any possible dementia. That's different than saying the president has narcissistic personality disorder, or the president is suffering from early Alzheimer's, which is a diagnosis. That sounds like splitting hairs, but it isn't. They're very, very different things. So getting to the last question you asked, could you make an exception? And, you know, we have exceptions for all kinds of things. You know, we have, for example, to balance, you know, privacy against safety. You know, if a patient of mine, let's say, makes a threat, which I think is credible, I am not just, able to violate confidentiality, but by law, I have a duty to warn a third party of a threat that my patient might present and break confidentiality and inform them that, my patient has said they're going to kill you. So, and that's Tarasov. So some people in my field have sort of conceptualized or, sort of extended this to the political area and said, well, we should use a Tarasov-like exemption for the Goldwater Rule. So in this case, what they argue is Trump represents a unique threat to the country. I happen to believe that's true. I think he does, for all the reasons that are obvious to anybody with half a brain. And therefore, because he does, we're going to break the Goldwater Rule because of public safety, and we're going to use our special knowledge. My only argument with it is not in concept, it's just in consequence. The American people don't need psychiatrists to explain to them why Trump is a threat. They can. That's the reason. Any more than the American people need a physicist, I said this in the piece, to explain to them what will happen if they walk in front of a speeding train. They're going to be struck and killed. That's why I find it kind of puzzling that my colleagues think they have a special role to play. It's as if they're telling Americans, you're either too dim-witted to see such an egregious, wildly, incompetent person for yourself. You need us to give you a special way and label to explain why that is the case. And I just think that's misguided.
The physicist, needing a physicist to walk in front of a train is was a very good line, by the way.
Thank you. I had something else that I was going to say, but it was an unprintable thing, which is, and it's also not as apt, but it would have been, you don't need a psychiatrist to tell you that, Trump is unfit any more than you need a gastroenterologist to tell you that he stinks. But which tells you what I think of the president, but it's kind of less apt in the sense that the president is more of a threat, like a speeding train. I think he is a unique threat to the democracy.
Now that we're able to say shithole, I think right. That you probably could have gotten that passed in the Washington Post.
I could have.
By the time we're done with President Trump, we're going to be able to say everything over the airwaves. He will have given us leave.
Right.
Richard Freeman, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to share your insights with us this week.
Pleasure. Thank you,
folks. Stay tuned.
Me.
We'll take a quick break. Thank you. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with prosecutor turned innocence advocate Mark Gotze from the University of Cincinnati School of Law.
You were best friend long time ago. Boy, you were home. Let there be night and let there be day. It's a wonderful world that we live in today. Loving one another, let the good things be. Life should make you feel so happy. Everyone is easy, happy and free. We should live together in harmony. Let there be night and let there be day. It's a wonderful world that we live in today. Why you want it? Why you want it? And children with fortune and fame, they all go together, they're all in the game. Everyone lives easy, happy and free. We should live together in harmony. So let there be night and let there be day. It's a wonderful world that we live in today. Whoa. We were back long time ago. Whoa, whoa. Let there be night and let there be day. It's a wonderful world that we live in today. Loving one another, let the good things be. Life should make you feel so happy. Everyone is easy, happy and free. We should live together in harmony. So let there be night and let there be day. It's a wonderful world that we live in today. Whoa, we were best friends. night and let there be day. It's a wonderful world that we live in today, Jah. We were best friends long time ago. Woy, woy, fledin, 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 woy.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Mark Gotze. Mark is a professor of law at the University of Cincinnati. He's the co-founder of the Ohio Innocence Project, and he has a new book out called Blind Injustice, A Former Prosecutor Exposes the Psychology and Politics of Wrongful Convictions. I have to say, it's a disturbing read, but an important one as well. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, you were an accomplished prosecutor in New York. You were a prosecutor's prosecutor, as you write in the book. You believed in the system in which you worked, and you were at first skeptical about the Innocence Project. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be an advocate for reform. What kinds of things did you see in making that transition?
Yeah, well, really, it was by accident. As you mentioned, I was, you know, a prosecutor for many years, and I was very proud of my job and loved being a prosecutor. And I went into academia to become a law professor, and the first school where I got a job had an Innocence Project. And when I arrived, they said, you know, the professor who runs it is on sabbatical this year. Since you've got a criminal law background, you're going to have to supervise it. I really couldn't say no. You know, I was untenured. I was the new guy on the block. But I remember being just like, oh, geez, you got to be kidding me. You know, there are no innocent people in prison. That was my view. And I went to the first meeting, and the law students were talking about this guy they just visited in prison named Herman May, and they were totally convinced he was innocent. And I remember just sitting there, like, sort of doing internal eye rolls, thinking, you know, what a bunch of bleeding heart, nonsense, romantic, you know, law students. But DNA testing ended up proving that he was innocent, and he was released. So it was just a huge eye opener for me. In fact, I call the first chapter of the book Eye Opener, because it's, you know, sort of made me realize that my assumptions perhaps had been wrong. I'd been a little bit too cocky about the criminal justice system that I'd been a part of. And so that first year, I really just sort of went through this process of trying to learn as much as I could. I'm from Cincinnati, and so the next year I got a job at the University of Cincinnati Law School, and there was Ohio at that time was the largest state that did not have an Innocence Project. So I had gone through a conversion in that one year, and then the very next year I founded the Ohio Innocence Project here at the University of Cincinnati College of Law. Since we founded in 2003, we've now freed 25 Ohioans who together served 471 years in prison for crimes they didn't commit.
So that's amazing. Transformation. Amazing. 25 people who had served over 470 years. So just, you know, basic math, that comes out to, oh, just under 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can imagine, our longest is Ricky Jackson, who served almost 40 years for a murder he didn't commit. And you'd think you'd be totally broken and a mess after, you know, going in at 18 years old and getting out when you're basically 58. He's an incredibly inspiring person. He does a lot of public speaking with me. In fact, I have a book signing coming up in Cincinnati in a week or so, and he's doing it with me. So these exonerees are often very inspirational people that make you realize that, you know, when you get upset about traffic or stupid things, there's a lot more important things in life that that maybe we're taking for granted.
Now, the book looks at wrongful convictions on kind of a human level. I mean, you offer insights into the psychology and the and also the political incentives at times of prosecutors and the police. But you don't discuss in the book how racial discrimination or implicit bias plays out in these injustices. That's obviously very prominent in the news these days, the mm-hmm. Black Lives Matters movement, et cetera, et cetera. It's not because you don't think it plays a role, right?
Right. I almost put an epilogue, and I decided not to. Maybe, you know, in a later edition I will. Here was my thinking on that. Obviously, racism is a huge problem in the criminal justice system, and it's a huge part of wrongful convictions. But what I'm focusing on is things like confirmation bias and malleable memory, things that don't get as much attention. And here's how I thought of it. You know, if I were to address racism, it would end up swallowing the book because it's such a problem. It's also addressed elsewhere in other books, and I'm sort of bringing out things that haven't been discussed before. And when you really step back and you think about racism, racism really, the building blocks of it are things like confirmation bias and the psychological flaws that I talk about in the book. And if you tell people up front it's a book about racism, everybody thinks they're not a racist. So they just sort of check out and they go, okay, well, this doesn't apply to me. But if you sort of disengage them or disarm them on that and you get them to learn about confirmation bias and tunnel vision and all these psychological flaws that we all have, I almost was going to have an epilogue that said, you know, like, in the end, this book really is about racism because these are the building blocks and now you've learned it and now you can go back and think of racism in a different way. So it's sort of subtly about racism, but I didn't want to directly attack it for those reasons. I think that the points I make about the other psychological flaws aren't getting enough attention, and I hope I make the point in the book that they are very important and need to be addressed.
Now, I think that there's a romantic idea, maybe it comes from movies and TV, that if you can find that key piece of evidence, the DNA evidence that definitively proves that your client did not commit the crime, is sitting in jail, prosecutors and judges will want to correct that error. They're seeking truth, they're seeking justice. And your book is all about how hostile police, prosecutors, judges often are towards efforts to absolve those who have been wrongly convicted and when there's evidence. And you detail how requests for evidence, for records are ignored or treated as some sort of, I don't know, effort to undermine the credibility of the courts. And yet you write that these officials who appear to be operating with an abundance of bad faith and dishonesty believe themselves to be the good guys and gals. They believe themselves to be doing the right thing. How do you square that circle?
Yeah, well, the first thing that sort of shocked me when I started doing post-conviction innocence work is, you know, we had several cases where he did DNA evidence and it was absolutely clear the person was innocent. And I saw these prosecutors like just going into denial and spinning all these ridiculous theories about how the person might still be guilty. And they almost make you laugh. And my first reaction was, are these people kidding? Like, are they serious? I'm in court thinking this. Like, is this a joke? Like, is this candid camera and there's a camera getting my reaction? And then there's going to be a host of the show that comes out and says, just kidding. I mean, that's right. How ridiculous it was. And the more I did this and started talking to people, I realized that, you know, what the innocence movement is doing is really pointing out some flaws at the basic core of the criminal justice system. And those in the system are really in denial about it. And I think I was too as a prosecutor. So I started studying the psychology behind it. And how, like, when you're in a bureaucracy that's very, frankly, cocky and it's been around for centuries and you become a part of it as a prosecutor and you believe that it's like this thing where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And then somebody comes along and says there's all these flaws in it. You know, it's very hard for the mind to sometimes accept. And so I think that's one of the things that's different about my book is it's, and I have a little bit of a grip on that as a former prosecutor, because I had that mentality as well. I mean, really, you have a hard time accepting, and you just tend to write off these people who are challenging the system as these outsiders who have these crazy theories and there must be some catch somewhere. And so they just become very closed-minded to any sort of claims of innocence. And that's one of the things we've got to change. I mean, in the private sector, you know, there are incentives for being open-minded and for playing devil's advocate. And companies, you know, if some executive wants to set up a new branch of their company out in the Southwest part of the United States, they're not going to let them just spend that kind of money. They're going to have focus groups and they're going to test the idea. They're going to test the hypothesis. And, you know, there's disastrous consequences possible if you don't do that in the private sector. But with the government, a lot of times we're missing that devil's advocacy. And so there's this sort of complacency and arrogance that just sort of sets in. And that's one of the things that the book tries to challenge and show that, you know, look, we need a different mindset here.
Now, you mentioned these kind of laughable theories that prosecutors will often offer to counter your claims. Just as an example, and I know this is kind of gallows humor, but what is the unindicted co-ejaculator?
Yeah, that's sort of a joke in the innocence movement. We refer to all these ridiculous theories as the unindicted co-ejaculator, which is a play on the word co-indicted or unindicted co-conspirator, which is a common phrase in American courtrooms. And its most basic iteration is you'll have a client who was convicted of rape, and he's been in prison 20 years. And you look at the trial transcript, and the victim at trial said, you know, this guy raped me. I wasn't sexually active. You know, and they collect semen at the hospital. So there's a rape kit that has the semen of the perpetrator. And the victim's testimony at trial 20 years ago is very clear that there was one person who raped her, you know, broke into her house or whatever the terrible the facts of the case may be. And so, you know, 20 years later, the Innocence Project does DNA testing and proves that the guy's innocent. And instead of accepting the truth, many times what you'll see the police and prosecutors do is they'll come back and they'll say, oh, okay, so the DNA, the semen that was collected after the rape doesn't match the guy in prison. Clearly, there must have been two rapists. Clearly, the victim was mistaken. Two guys broke into her house. We're getting the DNA results of the other person. We don't know who it is, but your client must have raped her too. He just didn't ejaculate. And, you know, it's just sort of like, are you kidding me? I mean, look at the trial transcript. She said she was absolutely certain it was one person. You know, and so no matter what the evidence is, they'll sort of spin it and come up with these theories in order to justify keeping the person in prison. And you just see it time and time again. So through time, it's become this phrase, oh, you know, you'll say to somebody, they're doing another unindicted co-ejaculator theory. That means they're just spinning things in ridiculous ways.
And this is common enough that this kind of bit of gallows humor has developed. It's disturbing. You talk about this idea of administrative evil. Individuals would not necessarily do things that they might do when they're part of a bureaucracy that subtly and otherwise affirms their actions. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, administrative evil is a psychological concept that came out after the Holocaust, where, you know, you had people that were otherwise good people, just regular Germans that participated in this, and thousands and thousands of them, and, you know, who weren't part of the Nazi party originally and just got, you know, and you see this in bureaucracies where the theory is that when people are part of large bureaucracies like the criminal justice system, and everyone's sort of moving in lockstep, in unison, and they're following certain policies. They're conditioned to, you know, do X, Y, Z in this circumstance. Prosecutors, in particular, and police officers will do things that cause great injustice, that they're really unfair, like fight these claims and not let an innocent person out of prison. And what they're doing is they're sort of, when you work in a bureaucracy like that, the values of the bureaucracy and the policies and the steps you're supposed to take sort of replace your internal moral compass. And I knew this as a prosecutor, where you get conditioned to just follow what you're supposed to do. And if you really could step out of that role, somebody could just sort of shake you out of that bureaucratic mindset and say, step back from this a minute. Look at why you went to law school. Look what you're actually doing to this person. Who cares about the policy? You know, you might have a different reaction. An objective person might have a different reaction. But when you've been in that system, you've been a prosecutor for 10 years, you've been a police officer for 20 years, you become so conditioned to just, my job is I'm supposed to fight this claim. I'm not supposed to admit that a mistake's been made. And you just sort of do it robotically without even ever thinking about it. And I give many examples of prosecutors who have done that and as how I did that as a prosecutor. I mean, part of the reason why I wrote the book is because, you know, I see all these problems that are being caused. I used to have that mentality. And so for me, it's somewhat of a confessional and a memoir where I'm talking about things that I did as a prosecutor that I now see in a totally different light, because I was just part of the bureaucracy and I got caught up in it.
This is Joshua Holland. I'm speaking with Mark Godsey about his new book, Blind Injustice. When you talk about people being kind of immune to the effects of their actions, you write that a key piece to all of this is the dehumanization that's kind of inherent in the job of locking people up. You have to see them as cases rather than individuals. And you've seen, and you detail in the book, prosecutors and judges who appear to be completely immune to the hardships that people who have been unjustly convicted of a crime suffer, often for years on end. Just as an example of this, can you tell us a little bit about Nancy Smith?
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens is when you're a prosecutor, and I was like this, after a while, you've dealt with so many cases that the people just sort of become numbers. The cases just become files. And so when I was a prosecutor and we win a case that would send somebody away for decades, you know, we would celebrate, go out and party, woohoo, you know, high fives and all this kind of stuff. And I sort of look back on that differently now. I remember at one point when I was a prosecutor, we were celebrating after we won a case, and the judge sent a note that said, look, this is a somber occasion. You know, this wrecks this person's family. Nobody wins in the criminal justice system. It's a necessary evil to send people to prison, but you shouldn't be celebrating. And I remember at the time thinking that was crazy. And, you know, one of my clients, Nancy Smith, was exonerated and freed, and the prosecution refused to admit that a mistake had been made. They kept appealing it, and they eventually got her exoneration overturned, not because she wasn't innocent, not because the court thought she was guilty, but because of jurisdictional issues. The Ohio Supreme Court ultimately said the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to exonerate her, which meant she had to go back to prison right now until we could, like, fix it. So she'd have to sit in prison while we relitigated the case, which could take forever. And so she agreed to take a plea deal in order that she wouldn't have to go back to prison. And it was just an absolutely gut-wrenching decision for her. She didn't know if she was making the right decision. And, you know, basically on the verge of vomiting through this entire court proceeding. The day that it happened, the courtroom was just full of cameras and Dateline NBC and everybody else was there. And the judge came out in his robe for this proceeding and looked at all the cameras and just sort of started laughing and said, hey, if I'd known there were going to be cameras here today, I would have gotten myself a haircut. And then just kept cracking jokes, and, you know, and hamming it up for the cameras. And I remember, just dawned on me, you know, I used to be like that. Like, this guy's completely oblivious to the human suffering in the room. It's just another day at work for him. Because he's been caught up in this bureaucratic mindset. And that's exactly how I used to be. And, you know, so I wanted to write about the effects of that and how you sort of lose your humanity when you've been involved in the criminal justice system for so long. It was like sort of sitting there watching a doctor tell somebody they have 6 weeks to live, but cracking jokes while they're doing it. And many in the criminal justice system, because we don't have the right training, we don't have the right mindset to fight these bureaucratic effects of dehumanization, administrative evil, and things like that. It happens more than it needs to.
And she was, I mean, she was clearly innocent. If if she had had a robust defense, would she have been in prison?
Oh,
tell us a little bit about her case.
Absolutely not. I mean, there's a whole Dateline NBC episode. It's an hour long. You can find online. Just Google Nancy Smith, Head Start cases, Dateline NBC. It's a great hour long episode. But yeah, there was. I mean, in the early 90s, there was a 60 Minutes episode where there was a daycare center that the parents alleged that their, like, 3-year-olds had been molested, and they all ended up suing the daycare center, and it was federally funded by Head Start, so they all got $1 million settlements, multi-million dollar settlements. After that 60 Minutes episode aired, there were these copycat claims at daycare centers all across the country, and they all had something in common, or many of them did, which is that they would be ones who had deep pockets, like they were federally funded or something else, and all these families got millions of dollars. We now know that in a lot, if not most, of these cases, the charges were trumped up, and the parents got these little kids to say things that weren't true. And Nancy Smith's case was one of those. She was a bus driver for Head Start, so she would go on a bus route, and she would pick up these little kids, like 3- and 4-year-olds, take them to daycare, and then at the end of the day, pick them up at the daycare and take them home. And she went to another job in between the bus driving, and so in the middle of the day when the kids are in school. And one of the parents got – several of the parents whipped up that on a particular day in question, Nancy didn't take their kids to school, but instead took them to her boyfriend's house, where they allegedly abused the children all day and then took them home at the end of the day. And what's amazing about this is, you know, Nancy has a bus aide, because you can't just have a bus driver on a bus with a bunch of 3- and 4-year-olds that, you know, the kids will go nuts. You have to have somebody in the back keeping them calm. And the bus aide would be ready to testify. That never happened. In addition to that, all the kids actually were marked present at school that day. On top of that, Nancy would go to another job between dropping the kids off in the morning and come back and picking them up at the end of the day, and the records show that she was at work that day. So there was conclusive proof from multiple sources that this never happened, and the defense attorney actually did no work whatsoever. The testimony of the children were so ridiculous. They'd changed their story so many times. It was clear to an objective person they'd been coached by their parents. He just thought that there's no way there was going to get a conviction in this case. Didn't put on any of this evidence that demonstrated innocence. And then she ended up having to serve 15 years in prison before all this came out, and she was ultimately freed. I mean, the judge eventually said, you know, he had no confidence in the verdict and overturned it and acquitted her as innocent. But, you know, 15 years in prison because of a defense attorney that basically laid down.
It's so disturbing. One would think that the kinds of problems you detail in the book would be less prominent in the world of forensics, because it's a field of science. There's a right. scientific method, people publish studies, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not necessarily the case, is it?
I mean, that's one of the things that I think the public would be most shocked about, because of all these television shows like CSI, where we think that these forensics are on par with putting man on the moon, like there's some, you know, amazing miracles of modern science. And the reality is so far from that. In 2009, the National Academy of Sciences, which is an independent agency, came out with a scathing report showing how bad the state of forensics is in this country. We need a complete overhaul. All kinds of wrongful convictions caused by faulty forensic testimony, sciences that are frankly junk science that are being used to convict people, have been for decades. I mean, I can go on forever about this. There's all kinds of examples. But even in addition to just the problem that many of the sciences that are used, so-called sciences with quotes, in the courtroom are not actually validated or reliable. We've recently discovered how confirmation bias plays such a big effect. Like there's a psychologist named Itiel Dror out of London that did these amazing studies where he went to like leading fingerprint experts and he said, you know, we have a case where a fingerprint expert years ago testified that the defendant's fingerprint was found at the crime scene, and that caused the guy to get convicted. But we now know the person's innocent. He wasn't at the crime scene. We know that the fingerprint expert made a mistake. Can you look at the fingerprint from the crime scene and the defendant's fingerprint from that case and tell us where the fingerprint expert went wrong at the trial so many years ago? And so that's what he would send to these experts. What each expert didn't know is that Itiel Dror had actually gone into their own case files, and they had pulled a fingerprint that individual expert had called a match in court years before and caused the person to get convicted. And so they're looking at one of their own things that they called a match, but now they're being told this is from a case where there was a mistake made. Of course, fingerprint experts don't recognize fingerprints they looked at several years ago. Like all they do is look at fingerprints all day long. So they didn't realize they were looking at one of their own cases. And he got 80% of them to flip their answer and to say, oh, yeah, this is not a match. There's a discrepancy here. There's a discrepancy there. And he's replicated this in all different sorts of the forensic sciences, because – and what it shows is how the human mind works, which has been demonstrated. I talk about this in great deal in Chapter 4 of my book. You know, when you're told an answer beforehand, your mind is set up to actually only look for evidence that confirms what you solidly believe the answer will be, and your mind won't even register conflicting information. So when these fingerprint experts – and this is what I did as a prosecutor – you're often told by the police and prosecutor, hey, we know this guy did it. We know the fingerprint's going to match. We know the bullet's going to come from his gun. Blah, 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 blah. Just confirm it for us. The mind actually operates differently when it's doing the analysis than it would if you were set up sort of blinded or more neutral. And so they're not seeing some of the discrepancies, which shows that it's not a fingerprint match. So it's just actually mind-blowing stuff. It's just fascinating how confirmation bias plays a role. And, you know, despite the fact that we know this, and despite the fact that in 2009 the National Academy of Sciences came out and said, we got to start doing this differently, we can't tell forensic scientists what the right answer is before they start. There needs to be some sort of screening mechanism there. Nothing's changed. They still do it the way they did when I was a prosecutor, which is basically tell the expert what the right answer is before they start.
And you talk in the book about how some of these professional associations really actively push back on real research that questions the validity of their methods. There's so much to chew on in this book. I'm probably going over time with you. Do you have a few more minutes?
I sure do.
Okay. So psychology alone doesn't explain all of the dynamics that you detail in the book. Having been on both sides of the courtroom, can you talk a little bit about the political incentives that come into play in terms of denying what is sometimes very plain evidence of innocence?
Yeah, I mean, I was a federal prosecutor in New York City, and the prosecutors and the judges are appointed by the president. You know, they don't have to run for re-election. They don't have to get the endorsement of local law enforcement. And so when I came back to Ohio, which is my home state, and started doing innocence work, I was absolutely shocked at how the judges just seemed completely politically aligned with the prosecution. The prosecutors just were, as I mentioned before, sort of in denial, hardcore. We're not going to admit the mistake's been made. We're going to try to keep this person in prison. The judges just seemed to just line up with the prosecution and just would ignore plain evidence of innocence. And, you know, so I detail in Chapter 3 of the book how the politics of elections, you know, cause prosecutors, they always want to look tough on crime, to just have knee-jerk reactions that they're just conditioned to just look tough on crime all the time instead of being reasonable in some cases. And judges the same way. I mean, in my local city of Cincinnati, we have elected judges. You know, the main person that the judges want to get to endorse them and to appear on commercials with them come a re-election time is the prosecutor. And this is common in, you know, the 38 states where we have elections. And so if they do something as a judge that's going to really upset the prosecution, in my county at least, many times the prosecutor will run somebody against them and endorse that person. So it creates this dynamic that I've seen in these innocence cases where the system is not really neutral and fair like many people expect it to be, where it's just, let's get to the right result, and I'm a judge and I'm supposed to just like look at the evidence objectively. It's really politically stacked against the defense and for the prosecution. And so I give many examples about that, and talk about that in depth in chapter three. I think anybody who's gone through what I've gone through would understand the need to move away from the election process, because one of the reasons the founders made the federal system set up so the judges are appointed is that we do need insulation from the political process for at least one of the branches.
And there is some research that shows that elected judges tend to be harder on crime, tougher on crime, as they say, than appointed judges.
Particularly in election years.
Particularly in election years. There is, you talk also in the book about this kind of casual bias where judges think of prosecutors as their team, whereas the defense attorneys are seen in many cases as kind of the adversarial, the visiting team, if you will,
right,
to the prosecutors, to the judge's home team. Briefly, before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about how you think some of the issues that you talk about in the book could be addressed with kind of common sense reforms.
Yeah, well, that's what chapter 8 is about. I mean, some of them are fairly simple. Like, there needs to be screening mechanisms set up for the forensic sciences so that the experts are truly using the scientific method. They're doing it in a vacuum and they don't know what the right answer is before they start. You know, that's a fairly inexpensive reform that can be done that we're still not doing. In terms of, you know, I have a whole chapter on memory malleability and how the way lineups are done, the way they show photos to witnesses and things like that, taint the outcomes. And so there's very simple steps that can be done that changes eyewitness identification process and interrogation process to cut down on false confessions. This is not groundbreaking stuff. The research on how to reform the system has been out there a long time, and I summarize that in chapter 8. Like I said, a lot of it is easy, like those things. Other things like changing the system so the judges and prosecutors are not elected anymore would be much more difficult. You know, and that may take generations or decades of yelling and screaming in order to get people to realize that that needs to be done. Maybe that'll never happen. But yeah, some of the things that are causing wrongful convictions and some of the leading causes, like eyewitness identification, false confessions, and faulty forensics, there are fairly inexpensive steps that can be done to really minimize the error rate. One of the frustrating things about it is that so little has been done, even now 8 years since the National Academy of Sciences came out and called for some of these reforms.
And that plays back into the basic thesis of your piece, of your book, which is that the system is set up to protect the system, really. And the actors within it have every reason to kind of play along. Mark, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I also want to thank Richard Friedman. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I'd like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars and Hullabaloo and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their joints. And of course, I would like to thank all of you fine individuals for tuning in this week. Have a terrific week.